Welcome to the Cello Sherpa Podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Icelandic-American cellist Sæunn Þorsteinsdóttir has performed all over the U.S., Europe, and Asia as a soloist with many orchestras and also as a chamber musician. She is a prize winner in numerous international competitions, including the Nomburg competition in New York, and she currently teaches cello and chamber music at the University of Washington in Seattle. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa Podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So your career is quite varied, but you clearly have a passion for teaching. And with all the different directions you could go in, what convinced you to pursue a doctorate of music and then a university teaching position?
I resisted teaching for a long time. I remember, well, first of all, my mom's a violin teacher. And so what I didn't realize was that even growing up, she was sort of pointing out excellent teaching, even from teachers or when I would play masterclasses or things like that. So I guess I had it kind of seeping in from an early age, but I kind of resisted it for a long time because I wanted to play. That's why I went into cello. I love the music. I wanted to do that. And after I finished my master's at Juilliard, I was sort of freelancing and I was doing this Ensemble Connect thing in the Carnegie Hall Juilliard two-year fellowship in New York. And there was a little bit of a teaching component to it. We were paired with a New York City public school and we would go in once a week and teach music to kids that really didn't have a lot of access to it. I remember the first time I went in, I played for them and there was a little boy who raised his hand and said, "What subway stop do you play at?" Because that's the only musician that he'd ever interfaced with. And that's how he saw it as, like, that's how musicians make their money, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's just kind of a side story. But I got into this sort of the incredible feedback loop that happens when you teach, the inspiration that I got from those kids. So it kind of started me on this journey. Honestly, I got a doctorate because I was doing a few passion projects that I was yearning for that feedback. I just wanted more guidance. I wanted more, you know, I was trying to navigate a career. I was trying to figure out how to do all the things that I wanted to do. And Colin Carr at Stony Brook was local and he's great. And so I sort of went into it not thinking that I was going to get a doctorate for a university job, more just as a vehicle for something that I was interested in getting, which was more feedback, more structure, I think, in terms of keeping me accountable for the projects that I wanted to do. Hmm. And I'd been freelancing around New York for a while and doing all this stuff. And I just realized, like, wow, if I keep doing this and if I don't keep up my own playing and my own projects, this isn't going to lead anywhere. Right. And so that kind of gave me that spark that I thought, okay, I want to go back to school. I want to try to really get to the next level. I wasn't happy with where I was and I needed a few more resources in order to go forward. Even then I wasn't applying for jobs. I wasn't really interested in formal teaching. I had a few students here and there, but it wasn't until this job opened up at the University of Washington where my boyfriend actually sent it to me and said, "You know what? I think you would really like it there. The people there, being in Seattle," and he had known Toby Sachs, who was my predecessor, who had just recently died, and he just thought that I should just go for it. And I kind of was like, well, I mean, it's a shot in the dark. I mean, I'm not really going to count on this. So I just kind of applied and just kind of sent my stuff and was sort of surprised to get the invitation to come and interview and play. And then I ended up really being enticed by the atmosphere, the sort of idea that music could be research. And that's a big part of this job, actually, is that sort of exploring, performing, commissioning, and really looking at music as a way to do research, and something about that really kind of tickled my brain. So I think it was sort of serendipitous that I got here, but I'm so glad that I'm doing this now.
So can you describe the music program at the University of Washington?
Sure. So for those of you who don't know the University of Washington, it's a huge school, I think 30,000 or 35,000 students. And it has a very high level science and technology. And basically, it's a really big deal in terms of just a school. And the music school is actually very small. And what I love about that is that it's really a part of a bigger environment. And so the students that end up coming, and it's actually kind of hard to get into academically. And so what I've found is that the students that come to the School of Music at the University of Washington are really smart and have a really big passion for music and are surrounded by really smart, creative, driven people. And I think that is such a cool combination. There's a big support network because it's such a small school. You get opportunities to perform, you get opportunities for support, but all of the really wonderful resources of a huge university. It's very different from how I grew up because I went to conservatories, you know?
And right.
So it's a very different thing, but I actually think it's a really great atmosphere.
So what kind of students would benefit most from that type of program?
I think students who are sort of self-driven, are really creative, are really interested in finding their own path in terms of what they want to do in music, and are interested also in the context of how music fits into society, how music will fit into the world going forward. As we know, this pandemic has really changed the way that we think about how we move forward in terms of our orchestra is going to look the same, our concert's going to look the same, our audience is going to look the same. I mean, we're sort of getting into this new frontier. And so I think students that are thinking about that and questioning that and wanting to sort of think outside the box, I think this is a great place for people like that.
In most of our interviews so far, we've discovered that many of our guests don't have much of a social media presence, but you really do. You have online courses, you run a Facebook page called The Cello Journey. You seem to be following an actual business model outside of just focusing on playing the cello. And this is rare. So I want to know what motivated you to develop this business side of your career, and how did you learn to market yourself and productize what we do into a neat little package?
Yeah, well, it sort of started as an idea because it was an idea for my online course, Cello Sound Alchemy, was a frustration from hearing so many young cellists struggle with sound and tension, especially now that I'm teaching. I just see a lot of people that audition for me or, you know, have trial lessons with. And I just found myself saying kind of a lot of the same things that could help, just fundamental things that could help a lot of people. And there's only so much time with my teaching at the university and my concerts normally. And I just felt like there was a finite number of people that I could help in the normal sort of one-on-one lesson, even through Zoom, right? There are only so many hours in the day. And of course, especially before the pandemic, I was dealing a lot with burnout. And on my mind was sort of, how can I make this more sustainable? How can I still do what I love, have a bigger impact? How can I make a bigger difference? And that's when the pandemic hit and I just thought, okay, this is my chance to do something with this idea that I've had. And then I just started trying to learn stuff. I just started to, okay, other people have made online courses. What's worked for them? And I started following people that knew what they were doing and looked like they were successful. So I started with the online course and then looking at experts. And then the Facebook page was just sort of my way of still being able to help people, even if they didn't buy the course, you know, if it wasn't the right fit for them or they had a great sound and didn't want to work on their sound. They wanted to work on their intonation or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I just found a lot of people were maybe not specifically looking for my course, but I still wanted to try to help as much as I can.
Well, when you were looking at these courses that other experts put together, were any of them professional musicians?
No.
Wow.
I think that's also part of this idea of being a part of a broader university. You just have a bigger context. I think as musicians, we get so sort of incestuous in our sort of thinking of being in our little pods of other musicians, right?
Yeah.
But there's so much to be learned from other disciplines and other people that are doing the same types of things, but in a different way. And I think it's really interesting to look at how that can help us in music.
I wonder if that's tied to the way that we're taught. There's just all the emphasis is put on, you have to play this instrument at the highest level that you possibly can and as close to perfect. So there's no time for anything else other than practicing as much as humanly possible to get that accomplished,
yeah.
Which leaves everything else on the outside. And that's what I'm learning. I think what we're learning as we go through these interviews is that it's pretty common in this business to take your path and go a certain road, a road that's already been traveled by many other people. And that's how you kickstart your career and that's how you become successful. But the pandemic, as you said, made a lot of us look at how we spend our time and what we want to do differently. And you obviously made the most of the pandemic. Not all of us have, which is really inspiring. So I was wondering though, when you work with your students, are you now covering the business side as part of the cello studies?
Yeah, you know, it is hard because a lot of it does have to do with how to play your instrument and how to interpret Bach and how to do all the things, because there is a lot to cover there. I think what I try to do is I try to sprinkle in a lot of vision work. And what I mean by that is sort of figuring out what it is intrinsically that motivates each student. And then figuring out, well, how can you make a life in music and make it sustainable for you? And along with that goes a little bit of that business stuff, but not necessarily from the side of how to make money. I like to look at it from, well, what do you want to spend your life doing? And how can we support that? Mm-hmm. How can you find a way to support that?
Then let's talk a little bit more about this. Motivation, putting together a mission statement. I mean, these are things that I know that you're passionate about. So can you expand a little bit more on how you work with students in these areas?
Yeah. I'm super obsessed with process. So even in talking about various cello-specific things, the process of practicing, how to get better, how do you unlock a technical problem? How do you do that? But I'm also thinking about how to reverse engineer these goals of, okay, you want to play in an orchestra. Well, what does that take? What's the step before that? What's the step before an audition? What's the step for preparing for an audition? Okay, you need to have a really solid technical foundation. Okay, so kind of going through that. And then I'm also just a big believer in what Clive Gillison at Carnegie Hall talks a lot about. He sort of hammered this into my head, which is money follows vision. And so the vision part is what we should be looking at, and creating that takes a long time. I remember really struggling with that at first. And I mentioned the Ensemble Connect fellowship, and that was part of the work we did there. And I remember just really struggling with, well, what do I really want to do in music? What is it that really drives me? And what is it, this intrinsic motivation? If I take out all of the external stuff, if I take away my teacher's approval, my parents' approval, you know, society's approval, or whatever, you know, the layers of things that we carry with us, what is this all for? Why are you doing what you're doing? I think if we can figure that, we can mitigate so many problems later on, like burnout, any midlife crises that may pop up. And so I spend a lot of time sort of talking about that with my students also. And some of them really aren't there yet. They're just trying to figure out, okay, I want to do something with music. I don't know what yet. And it took me a long time. I thought I wanted to play in an orchestra when I was straight out of school because I love playing orchestra, but it turns out I love music more. Mm-hmm. And so then, well, how do you play more music, right? And if you're not in an orchestra, and all of those kind of questions. It just helps to even ask the question, and then the answers sort of take their time to reveal themselves, I feel.
Yeah, so if there's somebody listening right now that says, okay, well, I want to put together my own vision statement, talk us through that, how that would work, how that process would work, what kinds of questions they should be asking themselves. Is it a 5-year goal? Is it a 2-year goal? Is it all of them? Is it a 10-year goal? How does this come together?
For the vision part, I think of vision as like the big overarching why of your career or your life. I look at even companies with great vision statements, you know, like Starbucks or something, to be the most recognized brand in the world or something, you know, like that doesn't have anything to do with coffee really, but it takes them down this path of having a Starbucks in every corner, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I think of the vision of, like, what do you want to spend your life doing? What is it that you already do in your life every day that you don't need motivation for, that you just do automatically? That is what you should follow, because then that's not going to be work. That's going to be something that you look forward to every day. So start there and then think about, well, what are the values that you really care about? Do you care about connecting with people? Are you really great talking to people, or are you more of an introvert and really value having alone time and sort of crafting something and then interacting with other people? So it's about knowing yourself, I think. And then the mission part of it is how you're going to do it. And that's kind of the part where we can get into the nitty-gritty of, well, what does that look like? Does that look like playing in a chamber ensemble? Does that look like playing in an orchestra? Or does that maybe look like starting your own series, starting your own podcast, doing other things, like maybe having a day job that you can support your cello habit with? Mm-hmm. Or there's so many different paths. It looks different for everybody, and the creativity really can show in how you make that vision a reality.
Does this also play into motivation? Because with that vision and with that mission, you have something to be motivated towards.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it has for me, and I've seen it also for my students, of they're really having a tough time. They just really can't get motivated, and they just have a down slump. And I think then we ask, well, what is it about this that is not working for you? Mm-hmm. Is it that you're not interested in this goal, or this isn't really your goal? This is your teacher's goal, or this is your parents' goal, or is this what you think you should be doing, or your friends told you should be doing, or so things like that. And then I think it also helps us, especially as I was sort of starting out, I was always saying yes to things, right? This mentality of, okay, I was a freelancer and all these, especially great opportunities, I just felt like I couldn't say no because they were prestigious or big, or I just saw it as something that I should be doing. And then realizing, wait, this doesn't really come back to my vision statement. This isn't really a part of that. So it helps me also to avoid burnout if I can say no to some things, which then leaves more space for the things that really fuel me.
That's a really good point, especially with a background of freelancing in New York, because I grew up 20 miles from New York.
Yeah.
I went to school in New York for a year, and I know exactly what that scene is like. Everything's moving 100% of the time, always. There's no break. There's no downtime. And especially if you want to be a professional musician in New York, the cost of living is so high that you're going to spend so much time working just to pay your bills that it really is hard to do anything else.
Oh, yeah.
If your goal is to get into an orchestra, and right now you're living in New York City trying to freelance and pay your bills, how are you going to put the time and energy towards taking auditions and practicing towards that? It's really challenging. Not a lot of people can do both of those things.
Yep, exactly.
So are there particular qualities then that you look for when it comes to selecting students for your music program?
I think it's kind of, for me, it boils down to, do you care about the music? Do you care enough that when it gets tough, that you have that burning desire to do it and really follow through with it? Because there's only so much, like, speaking of motivation, there's only so much that I can do to pep you up or be really hard on you. And there's a certain point where you have to kind of step in and say, well, do I really want this? And sometimes it's not easy to see in an audition setting. And people think, sometimes it's like, oh, if I'm nervous, then I can't play my best. Well, I actually see nerves as a good thing. Mm-hmm. It means that you're putting yourself on the line. You're taking a risk, and you know it.
Yeah, that you're invested in it.
Yes. And I actually see that as a positive. Not that I want everybody to be nervous in their audition. I try to make people feel comfortable, but I don't see that as necessarily a negative. And if you come and really try to communicate, even if you have hurdles or if you have maybe technical things that you haven't figured out yet, that doesn't necessarily mean that by the end of your 2 years or 4 years together that we can't figure that out.
Right.
And then, you know, you can really soar.
Yeah, I mean, being a perfect student in an audition, you don't necessarily look at that student and think, well, that person's perfect, so how am I going to fix them? it's more like there has to be some growth that's needed and this openness to learning. I mean, there really is no such thing as perfection as we know. But I mean, just going through the motions of playing something, let's say so-called perfectly, isn't necessarily enough to pique somebody's interest in taking you on as a student. There has to be something there that they see that they feel like they can work with you on.
Yeah.
And that's been really interesting too, is talking to the different professors in different schools.
Yeah.
About the kinds of things that interest them in students when they audition. And we've talked a lot about trial lessons. So I'm assuming that that's something you also do.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Something that popped in my head as you were saying was that I remember so clearly Yo-Yo Ma telling me once that he actually did have one recital that he played perfectly. And he never wants to do it again because it was the most boring concert and everybody hated it. So I just think of that sometimes when I'm trying to play perfectly for whatever reason, for an audition, for a concert or whatever. It's like, really, is that the goal here? No. If Yo-Yo, you know, isn't going for that goal, then I don't think I should be going for that either.
Yeah, I think that is part of the challenge with the orchestra audition world. There really is this focus on perfection.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes you have to remember that you're still trying to play music and you have to find that balance. And it's a really delicate balance if you talk about a section string audition for an orchestra. And of course, people have different things that they value, whether it's intonation or rhythm or whatever kind of phrasing, people are turned on and off by different things that they hear from players. So then you have to then figure out how to guess what a committee might like to hear, which of course is a never-ending circular battle that's not going to serve you well. So really, at the end of the day, we have to think about what we're doing with the music and always be serving that first. Of course, I will say with the one caveat that you have to play with really great intonation and rhythm first before you can worry about being the most expressive player, because if those other things are missing, and of course, sound is subjective, but we all need to have a beautiful sound too.
Absolutely.
So there's just so many elements to consider, and I think it's a great point about thinking about when you play a concert and thinking about perfection versus having a musical experience and what's important.
And I would add that if your highest concern is the music, then of course you want to play, you know, with exquisite intonation. Of course you want it to be super clean because that serves the music.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're only thinking about your intonation, your cleanliness or whatever, that doesn't necessarily serve the music.
Yeah.
Right?
That's
so
true.
It's kind of, you can't have it the other way around.
Yeah. Well, you're very connected to your Icelandic heritage and a real force for bringing that music forward for more people to hear. As a matter of fact, the Classical Classroom podcast, episode 180, has a fantastic interview with you covering this subject in depth. So for a more in-depth conversation about the history of Icelandic classical music, make sure you catch that episode. But Sayun, tell us why it's important for you to stay connected to your roots in this particular way, and what is unique about the Icelandic classical music scene?
Thank you. It's funny that it's become such a thing. You know, when I first came to the States, I came to the States when I was 7. People didn't know what Iceland was. They thought it was a level on Mario Brothers or something, you know, Iceland, it was like a thing. And it was just sort of something that people didn't know about. And more recently, it's become much more sort of known about. And for me, it was that I wanted to just connect the different parts of me. Mm-hmm. I felt for a long time growing up, there were two different things. There was Iceland and family and the language. And then there was America and cello and music. Hmm. And so sort of coming back as an adult and seeing and hearing and connecting with the music scene there really just opened up a lot of creativity and I think authenticity in myself. You know, I felt like I could bring together the different parts of myself. So it was selfish. I mean, why Icelandic music? But I also got so much inspiration maybe because the Icelandic music scene is so creative and different, I think, from what I was seeing in America, that I just felt like, why not me? It's such a small place. There aren't that many people playing classical music, doing what I'm doing. And I just felt like this is an opportunity to really showcase this. And if I wasn't going to do it, there wasn't anybody else who was going to do it. And so I just thought, okay, I want to try to commission as much as possible. I want to try to play as much as possible. I want to try to give this music an audience that is, I think, is out there. And then this CD just sort of came to be as a project. I thought I was playing all this music and I just really wanted it to have a bigger life. And so I put together sort of four pieces that really meant a lot to me for my album, Vernacular.
Vernacular. And where can people find that album?
Anywhere that you get your music. It's on streaming services like Spotify and Apple Music, or you can buy it on places like Bandcamp or Amazon or wherever you get your music.
Okay. And that's not the only album you've recorded, correct?
No. In fact, my first album was of the Britten cello suites, because I really loved those. Yeah. So those are sort of my two solo albums. And then recently, I just recorded a concerto by Páll Ragnar Pálsson called Quake with the Iceland Symphony, which was actually nominated for a Grammy.
Oh, that's exciting.
Pretty exciting. Congrats. For an Icelandic, our little island in the middle of the North Atlantic.
Congratulations. So. Well, I think that shows that what you're doing is sort of serving the purpose that you intended to, which, as you said, who else is going to do this if you don't?
Yeah.
And clearly you're making an impact. Well, is there any other advice you'd like to offer to our audience that we might have missed today?
Wow, I feel like we've talked about a lot of different things, but I think if I were sort of listening to this podcast and I'm thinking of myself, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago, I would say, pick your idols intentionally. Just because someone has a huge career or a big following or is the principal cello of your, I don't know, youth orchestra or something, it doesn't necessarily mean that their solutions are the right ones for you. I remember I had a lesson, I got a chance to play for a really famous cellist who will not be named. And at the time I was really struggling with sound, which is partly why I made this online course, because for a time I was always being told I was getting these opportunities to play with amazing violinists, pianists, and great orchestras. And I was always being told to play out more, play more, play, mm-hmm. Play more. And I had this lesson and he told me to get a bigger sound, you just have to squeeze your bow hand. And then if it sounds squeezed, just add vibrato. And I later found out that he had had multiple wrist surgeries for carpal tunnel because of the repetitive stress that he puts on his wrist.
Yeah.
I just think about that like, wow, that really wasn't a great person to follow. I mean, I didn't know that at the time, but I just wanted to put that out there. Like, just because someone is famous doesn't necessarily mean they have the solutions for you. But then the flip side of that is, once you've found someone that you trust, that you align with, that you can be inspired by, follow through with that person's advice or their plan or their, if they have a plan for you, don't look the other way or another way when it gets really tough. I like to think of it like you're trying to get to the other side of a river. And if you start building a bridge, but quit every time it gets tough and start another bridge a little further down the river, you could be building 15 bridges and never get across the river.
I like that analogy.
If you have a teacher who has your best interests in mind and really is helping you, go with them. Don't always be looking, oh, this teacher says this and this person, you know, these little tips and tricks and all that stuff. Go with that person and really follow through, because that's the only way that you're going to really get to the other side.
Tell us briefly then about the sound alchemy that you're talking about so that people know where to find you and then also where else they can find you online.
Yeah. So for your listeners, I actually made a little free resource for anybody that is interested in healthy tone production on the cello. I found a lot of people didn't know how to release their bow arm or didn't know how to use gravity or didn't quite know how to connect the bow with the string in order to get that juicy, rich cello sound that we all fall in love with, right? And so if you're interested in really diving deep into that, I have a video at sayun.com/sound. So that's SAEUNN.com/sound. And you can check that out. I talk about sort of the three biggest mistakes that I see people make. If you're listening to this and you're like, oh yeah, I want to work on that, check it out. In terms of finding me, I'm on Facebook and Instagram, Sayoon Cello, and I do also have my website that you can check out, sayoon.com.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview Amy Pollard, professor of bassoon and associate director of performance at the Hugh Hodgson School of Music at the University of Georgia. We're here to serve you, so if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like us to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us, @thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Be sure and subscribe to the Cello Sherpa podcast so you'll be notified when our next episode posts. Today's episode was produced, recorded, and edited by me, Joel Dallow.